But as we realise some of the challenges that we're facing due to climate change and potentially some of the impacts of our agricultural production systems on soil health and the kind of way it's impacting future yields, I think everyone's had to reevaluate some of those systems and look for some options that are less impactful on our farms, really.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Mark Licht, Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist at Iowa State University. Please subscribe to our channel to receive notifications of new episodes. Today, I welcome to the show Nicola Cannon, who is a professor of agriculture at the Royal Agricultural University in England. She has interests in low-input and organic farming systems, as well as specialties with crop establishment, legumes, cereals, and nutrient cycling. Welcome to the show today, Nicola.
Thank you.
Let's start, just jump right in and have you describe to us kind of your academic and your career path and how you got to where you're at today.
I studied agriculture at University of London, Y College, and then completed a PhD at Reading University, looking at sheep grazing wheat, which was a forgotten practice, really, and remained forgotten after my PhD, really, in the mid-1990s, and now rears its head again as an interesting practice to consider. I worked in precision farming for a while, and throughout I've really been interested in finding more sustainable solutions, being less reliant on inputs, and creating successful yields with some yield stability. And that's taken me to my role at the Royal Agricultural University, where I get the opportunity to do lots of different crop research.
So you mentioned a kind of a buzzword in sustainability, and we've had various I'll call it efforts, you know, in pushes in the sustainability range here in the U.S. for, well, really going on 20 some, you know, or more years. Has it been something very similar in England as well?
Yeah, I mean, the Soil Association, who were part of the start of the organic food movement, have been strong for a long time. And actually, the neighbouring farms where I grew up were very interested in this, which would have been over 30 years ago. But at the time, everyone was lured by higher yields and the opportunities of margins that could be achieved by this. And people were very hesitant about breaking away from the norm. But as we realise some of the challenges that we're facing due to climate change and potentially some of the impacts of our agricultural production systems on soil health, and the kind of way it's impacting future yields, I think everyone's had to reevaluate some of those systems and look for some options that are less impactful on our farms, really.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It comes with a trade-off, you know, in a lot of things in how we view, you know, productivity and profitability versus really thinking about some of the environmental impacts that our practices have.
Yeah, a phrase that we kind of think of it, sometimes things are too good to be true. And those systems which supported big population growths and complete changes to the way that much of the world farmed, now we have a price to pay for it.
So along those lines, then, what do farmers need to do to make progress in this journey to kind of a net zero and a net carbon zero, is I presume what you're meaning?
Yeah. So one of the big factors that's responsible for a lot of energy emissions as well as greenhouse gas emissions is the use of nitrogen fertilizers, which are manufactured using the Haber-Bosch process. And the problem is that our high yields are highly linked to the use of these products. It's really hard to find alternatives that work as well as ammonium nitrate or urea or whatever your chosen nitrogen fertilizer is, if it's synthetically manufactured. Often the alternatives have much lower percentage nitrogens, or they're more difficult to handle, or they're more costly, or all of those factors together. And to get towards net zero, that's one of the major nuts to crack, really.
Yeah, we've had various efforts, you know, looking at, you know, in the U.S. and in Iowa specifically, looking at how do we kind of manage nitrogen and manage nutrients altogether. You know, I grew up on a farm, and one of our most prevalent nutrient sources was often looked at as a waste product, right? It was the manure, and it was, you know, how far can we afford to spread that versus getting the value, you know, truly getting the value out of that. I think a lot of farmers now are starting to see the value of it, know that they're getting much more than just the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, you know, that comes along with it.
And that's part of the product of specialization, isn't it? You know, all livestock units had to get bigger to justify the investment required, and subsequently kind of cropping farms as well specialized to be able to deliver the higher yields with increased mechanization and benefits of modern farming systems, really.
What's the availability of bio-based fertilizers look like in England? And then, you know, what are some of the challenges and opportunities that come along with using bio-based fertilizers?
Yeah, so human sewage sludge is the obvious one. And obviously, being on an island up until, I think, really the end of the 90s, I'd have to check that date exactly, there was more disposal of waste at sea. There's still some issues with sewage overflow going into our watercourses, and therefore it's not ending up on our farms or where we want it to be. So there's nowhere near a circular system. But there has been a mindset change by farmers in how they view sewage sludge. So it used to be that they were paid to take it. Now they basically get most of it and they're just paying for spreading or a small amount for receiving it. And so they're valuing the nutrients in it. They're restricted on when they can apply it and where they can apply it, dependent on cropping and depending on soil nutrient levels. So yeah, it has seen a change. And then of course the other biofertilizers are livestock manures, and like most of the world, we've seen a specialization. So I mentioned I grew up on a livestock farm. It was because it was heavier clay and some flooding in that area. So you tend to find lots more manure in these areas. We've got areas now very heavily specialized in poultry production. And so phosphate indices have gone really high in these areas. But for much of the country, phosphate levels have been declining over the last 30 years, which means it needs to come from somewhere. So again, it's this kind of lack of circularity and centralized food systems that have caused some of these issues, really.
Are you seeing any interest or even, you know, companies coming in that are using like biostimulants or biologicals as a way of increasing nutrient cycling, or looking at those, you know, again, a biostimulant to help with that plant growth and productivity as well?
Yeah, the biostimulant market's a busy place and a difficult one to navigate. It's not covered by pesticide regulations at the moment, which make farmers slightly more vulnerable to buying products that don't necessarily deliver the benefits that they say they do. And also, it just seems that over the last 5 to 10 years, climate change has been much more of an issue for farmers. We're never quite sure if we're going into a really dry year or a really wet year. And the performance of some of these products is heavily interacted by what weather conditions we have. So there are some products that are proving slightly more successful, and definitely bio-based insecticides or non-chemical insecticides are becoming much more popular. Farmers can or could actually receive money for zero insecticide options to try and encourage biodiversity back. Yeah, it is a really difficult space, and it's difficult to know which products to trust.
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, we are in the U.S. is that there are a lot of products available, becoming available. And it's a matter of how do we evaluate those products and do we get the value out of them, you know, that farmers are really hoping for.
Yeah, and some are claiming, you know, enhanced nutrient uptake as well as improved disease resilience. And it's really difficult because we've traditionally had products that are fertilizers or are fungicides, or and suddenly we're seeing something that's kind of enhancing plants' resilience, which is much more difficult to quantify.
I'm going to switch gears on us here a little bit and ask a couple questions here regarding soil health or regenerative agriculture, and really getting at what does that look like in England? You know, is that, you know, countering or factoring in kind of crop rotations, cultivation, establishment and everything there too?
Yeah, so farmers are basically working by the same 5 regenerative farming principles. Lots of farmers for a long time have been working on reducing the intensity of tillage to establish crops. It helps to save fuel and time in that process, and it's often quite a small period of time. But the fact that this has been associated with helping to reduce carbon emissions or even sequester carbon in soils is seen as beneficial. And then it's been taken a step further more recently that farmers are now considering diversity. They're looking at putting cover crops back onto farms, which helps with the principle of maintaining living roots, and soil armor during the winter to help avoid erosion. But the big one that really makes a difference is integrating livestock back onto arable farms, cropping farms. And we're seeing much more of this, but it, you know, it has some logistical challenges along the way. And there's lots of farmers really trying to understand how best to work with integrating livestock in. How far do they go? What it's costing them? What are cover crops costing them to grow? And then they kind of want to know how they're going to see the benefit. So it's really difficult to budget on how that may improve your soil's resilience. So lots of farmers look for immediate price premiums. And there are some around, but they're short. And I think in some ways, it's when farmers lose access to markets that they then have to consider meeting these criteria, but it's not legally defined as yet, which makes it really difficult to know where the boundaries are, whereas organic farming is legally defined. There's a set of rules and you can be non-compliant to that, and therefore you know what you've got to do to farm within those boundaries.
Yeah, as you started to talk about, you know, bringing livestock back to those arable or crop farms and using cover crops, it made me think many of our listeners are probably more U.S. based. What type of crops are being grown on the farms in England?
Yeah, generally we are, wheat is our number one arable crop, barley, our second cereal, really. oilseed rape, or canola as you would call it, is an important break crop away from the cereals, apart from we've had really big issues since about 2013 growing canola, because we had the ban on neonicotinoid seed treatments, where we've been seriously threatened by cabbage stem flea beetle, which has made crop establishment really hard. And even if we get through that phase, quite often we find really high larvae numbers within the stem. So farmers have really struggled for a non-cereal crop within the rotation. It would have been beans before, but because of the relatively cheap price of importing soya into the UK, it's made it less viable to grow beans. And then you kind of come into the crops like potatoes, sugar beet, but they tend to be focused a bit more in areas of the UK where there's processing for them, and the veg in amongst that. And energy crops are becoming a much bigger thing with anaerobic digesters. And I'm not even going to start on bioethanol, because that's a bit of a hot topic between the two sides of the Atlantic.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. That's it was just interesting to kind of hear, you know, what crops are you're growing, and it sounds like there's a relative challenge in, you know, how do you rotate out of, you know, a cereal grain essentially?
Yeah, exactly.
It seems like limited opportunities there.
Most of the UK is too north for grain maize, or corn, as you call it. And then forage maize only works if you've got livestock to feed it to. But much of our country is still grass, you know, 65-70%. But mainly a lot of that's in the areas like the uplands or wetter areas.
And so with using, you know, wheat or rye really as the predominant crops, how are you rotating in or using cover crops? Are you looking at certain species there?
Yeah, so wheat is predominantly winter sown, meaning we're sowing it September, October. October is our main month. This year, some went in September. Barley is a bit of a mix. So we are really good at growing malting barley. In fact, we export a lot to the States as well, or have done at times. And that you need relatively low grain nitrogen levels for. It's predominantly spring grown. So it may be that you come out of winter wheat, harvest it in early August, and immediately sow in with a cover crop. Maybe something like mustard, phacelia, in a mixture. Some people use fodder radish, some people use stubble turnips, things like that. So quite a lot of focus on brassica species within there. And then depending on their availability of livestock, ideally you graze it off, because then it has some value to the sheep that are, or cattle that are eating it. If not, you have to either cut and mulch it down, and probably spray it off with glyphosate to just get rid of a big mat on top of the ground, which can be quite a problem for the subsequent emerging crop. So mainly cover crops are being used from harvest to spring sowing crops. So, for example, on my university farms, we also grow spring peas for human consumption, and we sow between whatever's harvested before that as well. And we're also planting some different wheats, such as spelt wheat, which is a more ancient wheat. We grew our first crop of durum last year as well, which was spring sown.
Oh, very good. So can you describe bicropping, and then how bicropping can be integrated into these arable crop systems?
Yeah, so bicropping, or some people call it polycropping, or it's basically moving away from the monocultures. So predominantly when I've been talking about the crops, I mentioned growing wheat or barley, and we focus on growing one crop at a time. And the main reason we do that is because we can meet the herbicide requirements, the fungicide requirements of that crop, insecticides, and the fertilizer needs. And we've really specialized within that, and it makes harvesting really easy. But one of the principles of regenerative farming is increasing diversity, and that diversity could either be the number of varieties you grow to create more resilience within the system, or the number of species that you grow. And by looking at plants that can grow well together, normally from different families, you can start to exploit different parts of the soil by different rooting zones of different crops, exploit light at different times because, for example, the crops ripen at different states and they're using have different canopy architectures, which means that we have seen in our research of growing wheat and beans together. I've also done projects on lupins and triticale, that you can increase what's called the land equivalent ratio. So if you sowed 1 acre in wheat, for example, you might say, oh, my standard yield is 3 ton an acre or something like that. I'm trying to work in acres for you, not hectares. And when you turn that into bicropping, it might be that you don't get 3 tons an acre of wheat. You might get 2 tons an acre of wheat, but a ton or of beans as well. Now, that total sum is the same, but if you think beans are normally lower yielding than wheat, the land equivalent ratio is higher than if you'd just grown wheat and then followed it by beans. And the big advantage we found in doing this is, one, you get better ground cover, but we found that weeds were controlled much better. So we had the same number of weeds germinating, but fewer weeds getting away and becoming big competitive weeds, meaning that there was reduced weed competition within the crops. And as technology is advancing, we're finding that now drills can quite easily do this. It's very normal for us to have multiple compartments on a seed drill. So we can run things down different cultures, and also combines wise. In some ways, we've made advances because you just press a button and say, this is wheat, this is barley, and that's your combine settings majority done. But the fact that you can, there's better sieves and better fans and things on combines means that you still harvest out two products together, but you can run them over sieves outside if you want to separate those grains thereafter. And the real advantage of these is if you can then say, well, I'm working to regenerative standards, and will you pay me a price premium for this by having maybe a product that appeals to a more ethical consumer? Obviously, we'd like to see that expanding as in a wider proportion of the population buying, but it's a start, really.
In a bicropping system, like you mentioned, is it maybe typical for, you know, on the farm side to be able to separate out the grains, or is that usually going to happen at maybe like a point of sale?
It's a bit of both. So there is some equipment you can hire on to farm to do it. It tends to be more expensive if you get to things like gravity separators, which are quite specialist bits of kit. But some farms just have sieves that they can run it over, and rather than it all going out as waste, they can collect, you know, just divert to different conveyors and things like that. So And actually are seeing more modern grain storage facilities becoming much more able to deal with this type of situation.
So as technology has improved and advanced, we're able to do this both from a combine perspective, but also on the grain storage and handling side.
Yeah, and it's amazing on the drill side. I mean, obviously, when we do plot work, you use small drills, but used to have to block off coulters and have different, you know, things down each one, maybe drill it at different times, whereas now you can run it all through together. So there's definite advantages. And as farmers press the manufacturers of equipment for these types of advances, we're seeing them coming along because it gives them a competitive advantage.
Yeah, very much so. I want to talk here real quickly about sheep grazing. I probably should have, you know, saved a little bit more time and jumped us into this, you know, a little bit earlier. But what are some of those challenges and some of the benefits as well of grazing with sheep on these arable crop farms?
Yeah. So, for example, this autumn, we've had quite a mild autumn. Crops are growing really well, and so there's quite a lot of green area on the crop, but it's also been fantastic conditions for disease as well, because it's relatively humid at this time of year. So by grazing off the canopy that's developed, you've got the advantage of the plant having physiologically developed and produced a good root mass at this time, but you don't have the disadvantage of going in with a large canopy carrying a lot of disease. So you can graze it down, and you have to be really aware of the physiological maturity of your crop. So for example, on our university farms, we tend to graze all our canola first, because already now it's setting buds for next year. And so it's too late now to do anything. Then we graze our barley, which is the next maturing crop, really. Then we graze our wheat. And we basically want to graze all our wheat or all our cereals prior to growth stage 30, so to the start of stem elongation, which in the UK, really, you want your sheep out by about the 20th of March. I mean, we shouldn't farm by calendar dates, but it's roughly somewhere there. And then between that, you've got cover crops around the farm before it's going into spring cereals. So many regenerative farmers now are saying that animals are on every field of their farm at some point during the growing year. It might not be on the growing crop if it's a crop of spring barley, but they are grazing on the farm. And then what we're often seeing as well is that plants can be a little bit shorter after they've grazed because they haven't got this lush growth on them so much, which can help reduce lodging risk. And it's just a bit of a reset button, really. And in the meantime, if you can capitalize on the sheep grazing on your fields, that's another source of income as well. And it's much better than just mowing. One, you haven't got to put a heavy tractor over there, and you haven't got the fuel associated with that. Secondly, whilst the sheep do take off some of the nutritional value that's been accrued within the crop canopy, they're also depositing a little bit of it back on, which traditionally was called the golden hoof, they called it here. And as well as that, they're grazing some of the weeds that are present with the crops. And of course, some of the broadleaf weeds have their growing point high in the plant, so they can actually be grazed out of the crop, whereas the cereals and the grasses, that's some people have seen success with grass weeds, but it's more the fact that grasses can withstand grazing, and you know that's why they're such a successful plant all around the world, really.
That's really quite fascinating to me. When I think about grazing, you know, in a cropping system, I typically think of, oh, we've harvested off the grain, the biomass or whatever we wanted to harvest, right? And then we do the grazing. And what you're really describing is really integrating them in together and really trying to get some very tangible crop benefits out of that grazing, you know, before it really starts to go into that reproductive stage.
Yeah, and we're generally seeing the reduction of at least one fungicide on the crop, which is a big help, especially as we're losing active ingredients. And one of the products that we used to use multi-site as the kind of first fungicide product of the season now, so chlorothalonil, we have withdrawn in the UK. And whilst we have some other options, they are more expensive and not as efficient. So if a sheep can do it for you, happy days.
It's time for our famous three.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Yeah, very nice. So we've come to the time where I need to move us on to our final three questions. So here we go. Here's the first one, and it is, what is your go-to agronomic resource?
Yeah, so in the UK, all farmers, grain farmers and livestock farmers pay a levy on products sold to what's called the AHDB. It did stand for the Agriculture and Horticultural Development Board, and they produce technical leaflets. We have things like the Wheat Growth Guide, but also material on pests and diseases. And it's so beautifully presented and it's updated. It's a fantastic resource. And so that's one of my number ones. And then just general kind of localized agronomy, often through cooperative farmer groups seeking agronomic solutions to challenges they're facing on their farms.
Yeah, farmers are definitely very good resources to have, even if it's to bounce ideas off of.
Yeah.
The second question is, with all that you have going on, what do you do in your free time?
I love to travel. I travel for work quite a lot, and I can't resist that when I'm traveling for work. So I've been in China, Uzbekistan, UAE, other countries as well, that I spend a bit of time and see the country, and often link that with long distance footpath walking as well.
Oh, very good. Very good. And then where can our listeners go to learn more about the research that you're doing?
Google Scholar or ResearchGate has my papers published. I also often try and link it to some more popular journals to make sure that it's in a kind of farmer-friendly format or public-sensitive format. So, I've done quite a lot of work with the BBC as well of challenges farmers are facing. So they're the main places, really. Google Scholar.
Yeah, a lot of people are very familiar with Google Scholar. And I like how you pointed out, you know, like BBC, you know, the local media is a really great outlet for a lot of research that does get done. So,
yeah.
Well, Nicola, thank you for joining us today. This concludes another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review, leave us a comment. Your feedback is very invaluable to us. Until next time, this is Mark Licht for the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.